Hi, it's Diane. On my mind, the state of the pandemic inside the White House and around the country. It's been 1 week since the public learned the president tested positive for COVID-19. Now, Trump says he's overcome the virus and wants to head back out on the campaign trail. But an accurate picture of the president's medical condition remains unclear. Equally murky is the fallout from the cluster of cases in the White House. In the meantime, public health officials warn of a virus resurgence as the weather gets colder and as the country continues to take a piecemeal approach to fending it off. I spoke with Laurie Garrett, Pulitzer Prize-winning science writer, about the state of the pandemic and what the next few months might look like. Laurie, it was just 1 week ago we learned that the president tested positive for COVID-19. What do you think we really know now about his health?
We know what he wants us to know. And that's all we know.
Which is very little.
He wants us to believe he's strong like a bull, robust, youthful beyond his years, cured. He's used that word several times. And that he can mingle with the masses and won't be a typhoid Mary.
And apparently he's sounding hoarse as he speaks. And is that because of the steroids themselves?
Well, there's no way for us to know. He may still have active viral infection with damage to his lungs and his trachea. Or it could be, a side effect of the steroids. We don't really know for sure because, again, we're not getting the kind of transparent information that would help us to understand what's going on. He also, we have to keep in mind and remind ourselves over and over and over again that this man has taken a cocktail no other human being has ever had. So the particular constellation of drugs he's been taking, I believe more than a dozen different medicines, on top of his pre-existing routine medication list, which was also extensive, we really don't know how these drugs interact. We don't know if he is likely to have any kind of side effects or synergism between them. And of course, we have no idea what his true health is.
What do we know about his routine meds that you just referred to?
Well, we know that he was taking Propecia for years for his hair, that he took Crestor for his high cholesterol count, that he was taking a drug to control his high PSA prostate level, and that he was taking tetracycline periodically to control rosacea, which was producing bright crimson streaks on his face, which is one of the reasons I think he uses so much bronzer makeup to cover that up. And there were other drugs as well. It's widely claimed, though I've never seen it proven anywhere, that he also periodically takes Adderall.
And what does Adderall do?
Well, it depends on your age. If you're a child, Adderall is used to deal with attention deficit disorder. As you go into teenage years and college, many people off the books use Adderall to cram for exams and so on because it brings in a sense of focus. And it's got a speed effect on adults. And then there are people all over Wall Street who take Adderall because they claim that they have miraculous performance under stress.
Now, given what you personally have seen of him or heard from him on television or radio in the last few days, how would you gauge his behavior?
Well, he certainly exhibited that kind of drug-induced euphoria when he was still at Walter Reed, claiming that he could be released. And then in his first press event or the walk up to the White House with the movie that was made by the White House with 9 camera positions showing him coming off the helicopter, marching across the White House lawn and appearing on the balcony. On all of those, he was exhibiting behaviors that are not truly abnormal for this man, but are more exaggerated, perhaps, than what we typically would see from Trump. What we don't know, and the list of unknowns is just gigantic, but we don't know really who's calling the shots right now at the White House and who is reining him in from his usual extremes, if anybody, because so many people, I believe the latest count is 34 people associated with the White House are working from home or are actually sick with COVID.
If you had the opportunity to talk directly with his doctors, what are some of the questions you might ask?
Well, the list is long. I would want to know why they put him on dexamethasone when the rest of his regimen, the experimental monoclonal antibodies from Regeneron, the remdesivir drug, and most of the rest of the protocol they had him on, all looked like early stage disease treatment. And were all drugs that show little efficacy later in the disease process. So they're intended for early stage. But then dexamethasone is really seen as a last ditch drug, something you come in with when an individual is in the intensive care unit and is very, very sick. So why was he simultaneously essentially on an early stage and end stage regimen? And another piece of that would be to ask, why were you giving him an immune system boosting regimen? That would be the Regeneron, for example. And then on the other side, giving him dexamethasone, which is immunosuppressant. It is a steroid. So it's very mysterious. It's very, it has this look of throwing in the kitchen sink, a little bit of everything. The other thing I would ask is, after all the pressure from the White House placed on the FDA a couple of weeks ago to reverse its own policies and give emergency licensing to convalescent plasma therapy as a treatment, again, for early stage COVID, why did they not use that? It was so touted by the White House. Peter Navarro famously said that the FDA was killing people if they didn't approve that therapy. And yet it was shunned by the president. I would also ask, after all the years that he, or excuse me, months that he touted hydroxychloroquine, why did he shun that from his regimen? There'd be quite a number of questions.
So he recorded a video on Wednesday and talked about Regeneron as a cure. From what you've seen and heard, can we assume that the president is cured?
I don't think we can assume anything, Diane. He called it a cure. If I were one of the chief scientists at Regeneron, I'd be very nervous because their drug is still in clinical development. It has not even applied to the FDA for a license yet. They don't have most of their own data unsealed on their placebo-controlled trials. For the president to be touting it as the cure in this complex regimen of drugs he was taking would make me nervous if I were at that company trying to figure out just how good is our drug and what exactly does it do to people and are there any side effects and so on. But the president has kind of jump-started all of that. And certainly nothing about the president's treatment constitutes a controlled trial. So we don't have, you know, any way of comparing anything of his experience to anybody else. And the nature of his care, that, you know, extraordinary presidential suite at Walter Reed, the army of doctors and nurses, whole chef team just for him and so on. Well, this is not a form of treatment that any other American will ever experience. So knowing what particular element of this, you know, hit the jackpot medicine may have made a difference is impossible. And then, of course, they are refusing to tell us when was the previous time that the president tested negative for infection. They've refused to give us that information. So we don't have a timeline. When roughly was he infected? Where everybody's assuming it was September 26th in the Rose Garden, in that ceremony for Amy Coney Barrett's nomination to the Supreme Court. But we don't know for sure. And no one's telling us, did he have a negative test the day before, 2 days before? You may recall that the White House had previously said, oh, the president gets tested every single day. And I think it's now quite apparent that was not true. But how much previously had he been tested? So what we don't know is he in day 9, day 12, day 15 post-infection, we don't know. And it matters greatly because quite a lot of people can feel ill, go into some form of treatment, feel much better, and then around day 11 or 12 suddenly sink and have a real downturn.
Why is that? What is it that happens that causes that sinking in that day 11 or 12?
Well, it's typical with many infectious diseases. If you look at HIV, for example, individual may get infected with the virus and then within somewhere between 3 days and 2 weeks, suddenly be hit with just like the worst flu they ever had. Super high fever, go to bed, feel rotten. But then they're over it in 3 or 4 days, typically, and they suddenly feel terrific, and they bounce back, and they go years feeling pretty great until all of a sudden, one by one, all the horror and nightmare of AIDS sets in, and their immune system completely collapses. That's over a course of 10 or 12 years without treatment. If we shrink that down, many other infectious diseases, similarly, some people, even with the flu, there are individuals who will get hit hard, have that headache and fever, that super fatigue, go to bed for a couple of days, feel better, go back to work. And then all of a sudden, after 2 days at the office, and by the way, infecting everybody at the office in the process, bam, they're back in bed and it's 2 weeks of just feeling rotten.
Well, that's something else I wanted to bring up with you. You talked about that walk up to the Truman balcony and greeting, I don't know how many people, once he had gotten off that helicopter. He made a dramatic gesture of removing his mask. Presumably, he was still in that period when he could be contagious.
Oh, for sure. Absolutely. I have no doubt whatsoever that he was still contagious at that moment and may still be contagious right now. The arc of contagion, again, since we don't know what is the genuine onset date, we don't know what's day one, then we have a hard time knowing whether or not he's still in the contagious window today. But certainly the Elections Commission is within their rights to say, we think it's too dangerous to put everybody on stage, not just dangerous for Joe Biden that he might get it, but for every other person involved in the stage debate.
Of course.
Camera crew, the audience members, the officials, and so on, and not to mention the moderator. So, you know, for he to make statements to the contrary without, again, providing the kind of evidence that would be meaningful is really, it's just a lousy, inconsiderate way to proceed. He's obviously eager to be speaking before giant crowds in order to win the election. And that's his number one priority. And he wants to be back on a campaign trail for the final 2 weeks leading up to the election. And he's quite determined that he won't wear a mask because that looks lousy on a camera, gives the wrong image. The optics don't fit. The Trump, you know, strong like a bull image. And he also wants to be sure that the crowds will at least come because they think that the president is indeed no longer infectious. And of course, the other part of this, Diane, that's so frustrating is it's not just that he's putting, you know, people immediately around him at risk, but they in turn put others in an ever wider concentric circles at risk. So, I mean, if you've got 34 identified infected individuals connected to the White House already, how many more are carriers? We just, a couple of days ago, actually on the same day as the vice presidential debate, saw film footage of the staff on their lunch break sitting around in the White House patio area, almost none of them wearing masks, talking and yammering away. So, you know, when the president goes somewhere, he's accompanied by a small army of individuals, policy people, his, you know, key decision makers and Secret Service and so on. And he's putting all of them in peril and everybody they're in contact with in peril. So it just seems to me terribly inconsiderate at the very least. I mean, rude on a very personal level.
Do you believe that the doctors who've been surrounding President Trump, have their reputations been put into question?
I think Conley and Dooley, who are active duty military personnel and are in charge of the president's care, are indeed in trouble. You know, they're in the classic rock and a hard place because he's their commander in chief. And if he says to them, I'm getting in the car with the Secret Service and doing a drive-by of the crowd to wave at them. You know, if he had been even the CEO of Amazon and he tried to pull that stunt, any private sector doctor would have said, well, I'm not approving that, sir. I mean, that's not okay. And similarly, to rush out to go back to the Oval Office already, even if he claims that he's well, cured, quote unquote, that he has no demonstrable virus in his body under nucleic acid testing. Even so, CDC guidelines are 14 days from time of testing negative out for the sake of protection of those around you. So if I were his physician, he's already violated all the basic bottom line instructions of human decency and public health. That his physicians have apparently allowed this to happen, either approved it or failed to publicly voice any concerns about it, definitely calls into question their credibility. And then it's been noted by many other critics that his lead physician, Conley, is an osteopath, not infectious disease physician, or even for that matter, a normally board certified MD. And osteopaths have a very specific set of beliefs about how the human body works and what is the nature of medical treatment of human disease that's different from what might be the first and primary approaches of, say, an internist or pulmonologist or an infectious disease expert. So all in all, I think his immediate physicians, the ones that were in command, indeed do have many questions to answer.
More from Laurie Garrett when we come back.
DCS Daily.
DCS Daily.
DCS Daily.
It's news,
culture, and curiosities.
From the District, Tacoma Park,
Alexandria,
Friendship Heights,
Hyattsville,
Falls Church,
Northeast Washington, D.C., in your inbox every weekday afternoon.
DCS Daily.
Sign up at dcs.com/newsletter.
dcs.com/newsletter.
Here's the rest of my conversation with Laurie Garrett. She's Pulitzer Prize-winning science writer and former senior fellow for global health at the Council on Foreign Relations. I want to go back to questions about Regeneron, which the president has claimed has cured him, and he has said would be available to all Americans free of charge. So Regeneron has said therapies could be available before the end of the year. Isn't that going to necessitate a huge amount of effort on the part of the FDA to approve that? I mean, the amount of testing and retesting and broadening of testing that has to be done before it's allowed onto the market. How are they going to do that before the end of the year?
Well, both Regeneron and Eli Lilly have had their monoclonal antibody products along with about well over 100 other similar competing products that are in the pipeline. They've been going through their clinical trials process all this time. So eyes have been focused on the vaccine makers, but the monoclonal antibody makers are also queued up. And in fact, their process is much more rapid than a vaccine process because they can go for very immediate clinical markers. You know, you just need to have individuals take it in a hospital and you look to see, does the fever come down within this amount of time and so on. And you have a set of clinical markers to determine whether the drug is improving the patient's course of disease faster than, say, a remdesivir protocol or a drug-free protocol with oxygen support or something of that nature. So they actually are, for the most part, moving pretty swiftly through the FDA pipeline. I don't have too much doubt that they'll have real data for everybody to look at the FDA and to mull over in November. The real question is going to be the scale up of production because these are not products that are typical in the pharmaceutical industry. These are active molecules, large protein structures. They would be highly contamination prone in poor production facilities. It's necessary to have a dedicated facility. You're not making, say, aspirin on line one and, you know, Regeneron's drug on line two. These are very carefully constructed facilities staffed by dedicated individuals that only work on this process. And my understanding is that they have been building production sites in multiple countries, that they're trying to scale up to perhaps having 100,000 doses. Now, when they say doses, it's confusing to me because I don't know if they mean by dose one course of treatment for an individual who typically needs five rounds of transfusion. So that, in fact, that's not 100,000 people, that's 20,000 patients each getting five doses. Or if they are referring to a dose as in a course of treatment.
I see.
So that's a little confusing. Each company uses their language differently. The other thing is it'll be very hard to compare the various regimens and see, you know, maybe Eli Lilly is even better, or maybe a drug down the pipeline from a smaller company is better. But it's going to be hard to compare them because everybody's using different markers in their clinical trials for testing. And this is also true for the vaccines. They're all very different and hard to compare.
I want to get to the vaccine in just a moment, but first I want to ask about contact tracing and to what extent you see that going on.
Well, if I were a student of epidemiology in grad school right now, that Rose Garden event would be my research project because it's just perfect in every single classic, you know, epidemiology 101. We actually know where everybody was seated. We have huge amounts of camera footage. We know who touched whom, who hugged whom, who kissed whom, who then went inside the White House into private enclosed rooms to have a reception, a cocktail party, a meeting with the president. We even know how long most people were potentially exposed in those rooms. I mean, we have so much data that one could probably do the kind of study that would be textbook that people would scrutinize for years to come, right? The problem is that the White House has now so far refused to let the CDC conduct such a study. At first, they claimed they were doing it themselves. We all wondered, who's the they? Who's the epidemiologist inside the White House? We were unaware there was such a person. And now we're hearing, no, there is no study going on. And now they're at great pains to try and suggest that there may have been some other event at which the president was exposed, that it might have been a meeting with some veterans' families, but that it wasn't the Rose Garden, and certainly wasn't any of the subsequent events over the course of that week that the president engaged in, including going to three states and several intimate home-sited fundraising events for high rollers, playing a round of golf. They've never even told us who he was playing golf with, which he did the day after the Amy Coney Barrett reception. The entire day was slotted out for golf in Virginia. There's just huge unknowns, and the White House is really at great pains to push it all behind, ignore it, not provide necessary information.
Let's turn to the vaccine. Can you talk about where the search for a vaccine stands?
Diane, there are about 250 products in the pipeline around the world to serve as vaccines. And those that are at the front of the line in the United States are not the same as what's in the front of the line many other places around the world. They can probably be broken down to about four categories of types of vaccines, roughly speaking. And the ones at the front of the line are at the front, not necessarily because they're the best or the most likely to be successful, but because they're the easiest and fastest to make. And those are products that were already in development when the entire epidemic was limited to Wuhan, China, based on the early January release of the genetic sequence of the virus that was first released, I believe, in the second week of January by the Chinese government to WHO. Based on that sequence, many companies started building a vaccine that is mRNA. So this virus is an RNA virus, not a DNA virus. And mRNA, messenger RNA, is what sends the actual code to make proteins, right? So DNA is the, to put it crudely, is the essential base of life, the hardcore code. And messenger RNA goes from the DNA to the whole machinery in the cell for making proteins. So the thinking behind making an mRNA vaccine is, first of all, the amount of genetic material necessary is very small. These are not only are they tiny vaccines, meaning there's a great deal of potency with a very small amount of material, but they're also very fast and easy to make. And so manufacture was really speedy, and most of those companies were able to get way ahead of other types of vaccines very quickly, go into animal trials and then into human trials way ahead of the game. So Moderna and Pfizer are the front contenders on the mRNA front here in the United States, and they're the ones likely to have a yes or no answer on their clinical trials first. And then other vaccines that operate by different methods and have a different way of delivering, you know, a target for your immune system to recognize and prime it, making antibodies. Those other vaccines are slower to manufacture, harder to manufacture in quantity, and therefore they're a little further back in the chain of development. However, there's a lot of reason to believe that actually the RNA vaccines are going to end up being the least effective and the hardest to deliver to actual patients, that they're going to require boosters. One of them for sure has to be stored at negative 70 degrees Fahrenheit. So you can't easily transport it from one place to another, and certainly not in developing countries. You don't just need electricity. You need really good electrical systems to store it negative 70 degrees.
So do you expect that there will be a vaccine on the U.S. market before the election or before the end of the year?
I don't think there'll be something on the market in 2020. Even the companies themselves are trying to lower the expectations. They're talking, you know, March 2021, April 2021. Several of them are talking what they say vaguely, second quarter of 2021. And I think that's because, first of all, the AstraZeneca, which had been the front runner on the global level coming out of the UK, everybody's charging full speed ahead. And then, boom, this 22-year-old, healthy, robust young woman volunteer comes down with inflammation of her entire spinal cord. And it looks like a transverse illness that is potentially very dangerous. So now that is in full stop for clinical trials in the United States. Trials are continuing with that vaccine in a few other countries. And meanwhile, the company is trying very hard to suggest that maybe the woman was in a pre-MS state or something like that. But the NIH has ordered a full bore investigation of not just her case, but rumors that some of the other recipients had perhaps other neurological issues. That one may be on hold. Meanwhile, there are no such claims about either the Pfizer or Moderna vaccine so far, and we're waiting to see what the game may be. The one I think looks most likely right now, based on available data, and all this could change in 2 weeks, but right now looks the most likely to be deliverable on a mass level with some lasting immunoprotection, is made by Johnson & Johnson. And they're using a common cold virus found in gorillas, not in people, as a sort of delivery system. So you're getting this gorilla cold virus that is harmless to people, and it's carrying in it all the key protein codes of the spike protein that sticks on the outside of the COVID virus, so that your immune system will react against the gorilla cold virus and at the same time come to develop antibodies against your spike proteins.
So the other night, vice presidential candidate Kamala Harris was asked whether she would be interested / willing to take one of these early vaccines. And she said, not if it comes from Donald Trump. Would you be willing to take one of those early vaccines?
Not if it involves pressure from the White House to speed up the approval process. And I think most of the companies are not interested in carrying that liability, even though actually Congress has waived the liability issues. But I mean, what good does it do a company if you rush something to the market for the sake of the president, and then it turns out to have 4 or 5 serious side effects that result in people massively refusing to take it, and your whole economic model collapses, and you've invested billions of dollars in trying to rush this thing to the market, and oops, you missed some key problem in the clinical trial process because you had to rush it through. So none of the companies are interested in having that play out for them. You know, we've now seen the 9 leading manufacturers have all put out a joint statement saying, we're not going to bypass any of the testing protocol. We are rushing, but we're still going to try and make sure that we're safe and that we're putting something out there where the promised protection is real. See, this is the other side of this that often gets lost in the conversation about vaccine development. A company isn't just taking a risk that they might have a side effect they don't notice. Their even greater risk is they might be overstating how effective the vaccine is. So, for example, if you did your clinical trial under very select ideal conditions. But then in mass circulation in, say, a community like one we're dealing with here in New York, in the Hasidic community, where there's opposition to wearing masks and social distancing, and we're now seeing a resurgence of COVID-19. Once a real world vaccination started, a community like that actually turned out not to be well protected. So you've got a safe vaccine, but it's not really working well. Now you've overpromised to the public. They've abandoned all their other safety precautions on the assumption that the vaccine is all they needed. And now you've got people dying of COVID, right? Even though they got your vaccine. That would actually be, for many of these companies, the worst case scenario.
We're about to move into the cold weather season. We've been told that and warned by Dr. Anthony Fauci and others. What are we to do in that cold weather scenario?
Yeah, I mean, most folks around the country have not really experienced COVID-19 in the context of cold weather lifestyle. We did in New York, and look at what happened. I mean, it was horrible. And I know everybody says, well, it was March. It wasn't January and February. That's true, but we had a pretty brutal March. The weather was tough. People stayed indoors, and indeed, we got really rampant spread. What happens indoors is that once you close the windows and you no longer have cross-circulation of air, then any one individual just in normal conversation, of course, removing their mask because now they're at home or they're indoors with people they trust, normal conversation can expel micro droplets of air that can circulate in a dry, warm airspace for a very long time. And we now know that humid weather allows the virus to form in droplets that coalesce with other droplets. So they become sort of macro droplets that then gravitationally end up down on the floor. In dry, hot weather, or artificial version thereof, inside of a heated space, then you have micro droplets that are so small that they can defy gravity just like a little piece of lint will, you know, and drift around in the air for a great deal of time. The other thing that will be limited is ultraviolet light exposure. So UV light is one of the things that decreases your risk of acquiring COVID infection, particularly outdoors, because ultraviolet radiation kills the virus if it's directly exposed to it. But of course, if it's circulating inside your home, there's no UV light unless you have huge windows and you're very fortunate on your latitude to get a great deal of sunlight in January. Very few of us are so fortunate. So we're about to go into something we've not experienced before. And it, you know, goes a long way to explaining what might have been going on in Wuhan in December and January. You know, central China is cold in January and really cold, and people are indoors regardless. A lot of these big towers built in these fairly new mega cities all over China are quite airtight. People would have all their windows closed tightly. They would be using whatever heat system is provided in those buildings, and they were not going outdoors. So they were basically breathing the same air over and over and over and over again. And we now know that explains a lot of how you reduce the risk of spreading viruses inside airplanes, for example. You spend more money on air exchange, which means you have to, as for an airplane, you have to adjust for air pressure and temperature, because the air from the outside is going to be at a different air pressure. By allowing the air in, you change the pressure in the cabin, but also it's going to be icy cold out there. And you're going to have to heat it before expelling it into the cabin for everybody to breathe. Well, one of the things most of the airlines have done to try and make their flights safer is to increase the number of exchanges per hour outside air they bring in. And this makes everything about the flying experience more expensive to the airline. But it's hard to do the equivalent of that for your home. I mean, if you open a window in order to keep air circulation happening, then you have to crank your heat way up to compensate. And it becomes incredibly inefficient. And anybody seated next to that window is having a fairly brutal experience in February.
Lori, what are you going to do? You and I both live in condos, apartments. Are you simply going to stay put? What are your plans?
I feel very comfortable about what I've been doing, and I'll probably just continue on the same course. You know, we've taken very strict precautions for the entire building. We limit how many people are in an elevator at any given time, how many are in the lobby, et cetera. And I go out at very off hours to once a week get food. I cook all my own meals. I do not order in. And I don't go to restaurants when I think that we have very active circulation going on in New York City. Right now in my neighborhood, we consistently are under 0.5% per day testing positive. So we're one of the lowest COVID transmission neighborhoods, arguably, in the entire United States of America right now. So I feel fairly safe about interacting with my immediate neighbors and so on. But when I go into a large public park or to a museum or anything like that, I definitely take many more precautions.
Lori, thank you so much for being with us. As always, so fascinating and so informative.
Well, it's always a joy to be with you, Diane.
That was Lori Garrett. She's Pulitzer Prize-winning science writer and former senior fellow for global health at the Council on Foreign Relations. And that's all for today. Thanks to those of you who've reached out to let me know what you'd like me to cover during these very difficult times. Please do continue to let us know what's on your mind. You can find us on Facebook and Twitter. Send us an email, prpodcast@wamu.org. Our theme music is composed by Jim Brunberg and Ben Landsberg of Wonderly. The show is produced by Rebecca Kaufman and Allison Brody. Our engineer is Mike Kidd. Thanks for listening, all, and please do wear those masks. I'm Diane Rehm.